For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site. It is July 19th from Malachim Beis, and we're in Perek Vav, chapter 6, and we are up to Pasuk Chav Dalet, verse 24. Vayhi acharei chen, was after this incident with Naaman, and with the people trying to capture Elisha, and then Elisha leading them to Shomron, they were all captured, and then we said that the people of Aram, the soldiers, no longer came on raiding parties. But as we said, the king of Aram had not yet subjugated himself to Hashem. Vayikvots ben Hadad melech Aram es kol machanehu. Ben Hadad, the king of Aram, gathered his entire camp. Vayal vayatzar al Shomron, and he went and he laid siege to Shomron. Vayhi rav gadol b'shomron, there was a great famine in Shomron. V'hinei tzarem aleha, and they were laying siege to it. Ad hayos rosh chamor b'shmonim kesef, until the head of a donkey was worth 80 silver coins. V'rova hakav chir divyonim, and a rova hakav, which is a quarter of a kav, which is that's a volume of divyonim, which is dung, b'chamisha chasef, cost 5 kesef. These are exorbitant prices for things that normally would not cost that much money. So there was a terrible, terrible famine in Shomron. Vayhi melech Yisrael over al achoma. So the king of Yisrael was passing over the wall, passing by the wall. This is Yoram ben Achav. V'isha tzak alev lemor, and a woman called out to him saying, Hoshia Adoni Amelech, my master the king, save me. So he assumed that she was asking for food. Vayomer, so he said, Al Yoshiech Hashem, if Hashem isn't helping you, may I know Sheikh, where am I supposed to help you from? Where am I supposed to get food from? Hamin hagoren omin hayakev, am I supposed to get from the granary or from the wine vat, the vat in front of the wine press? There's nothing there. Where am I supposed to get food for you? So, but then the king, she persisted. The king realized that she wasn't simply asking for food. Vayomer la hamelech malach. So the king said to her, what is with you? What do you need? And she said, Ha'isha azos amra elai, this woman said to me, Tinias b'neich v'nochlenu hayom, give me your son and we will eat him today. The son was dead. And she said, give me your dead son and we'll eat him today. Ves b'ni nochal machar, and my son we will eat tomorrow. So we'll share yours today, we'll share mine tomorrow. Vanevashel es bini, so we boiled my son, vanochlehu, and we ate him. Va'omar eleha bayom ha'acher, and I said to her on the next day, Tini es b'neich, give me your son, vanochlehu, we'll eat him. In other words, let's keep your end of the deal. Vatachbi es bina, and she hid her son. So she was coming to the king in order to get justice served and make this other woman keep her end of the deal. So obviously this is a gruesome deal that was made, and this succeeded in sickening the king. Pasuk Lamed, verse 30. Vayihi chishmoa hamelech es divrei ha'isha, and it was when the king heard the words of the woman, vayikra es begadav, he tore his clothing, v'hu over al achoma, he was passing on the wall, which means that he was in a public place. Vayar ha'am, the nation saw, and when he tore his clothing, they saw that sackcloth was on his flesh within the clothing. In other words, he was wearing clothing over sackcloth. People didn't realize the king was wearing sackcloth, but once he tore his clothing, then they saw there was sackcloth on his flesh. Vayomer, he said, So Hashem should do to me, and He should do more. This is a language of an oath, saying even worse should happen to me. Im yamod rosh Elisha ben Shaphat alav hayom, if the head of Elisha ben Shaphat remains on him today. In other words, he took an oath that he is going to behead Elisha. The king is blaming Elisha for this terrible famine. Why was he blaming Elisha? Because he knew that Elisha had the capacity to daven and end the famine. And since Elisha wasn't doing it, the king blamed Elisha for the famine. Now, clearly that is somewhat presumptuous. Why is there a famine in the first place? That the king is not addressing. He's just addressing how the famine could end if Elisha would daven, and therefore he blames Elisha. So the king resolves that he is going to have Elisha killed for what he's doing, that he's not davening to remove the famine.
That's not going to help.
Well, it won't remove the famine. That's correct. But it'll punish Elisha. But that's a very good question. Well, let's keep reading. Hold on. Let's not get the world yet. Pasuk Lamed Beis 32. Ve'Elisha Yoshev Beveso. Elisha was sitting in his home. Ve'azekenim Yoshvim Ito. And the elders were sitting with him. Ve'yishlach Ish Milefanav. And he, Elisha, sent a man from before him. B'terem yavo hamalach elav, before the messenger of the king came to him. Meaning, Elisha already knew what Yehoram, the king, had said. And therefore, he sent one of the men who was in front of him. He sent from before him, here the word malach means messenger. Before the messenger of the king came. V'hu amar lezekinim, and he sent, I'm sorry, Vayishlach ish milefanav means the king sent a man from before him. He was sending a man to go kill Elisha. So before that messenger came to Elisha, Vu amar lezekinim, he said to the elders, Hari'isem, have you seen? Kishalach ben hamiratzea chazeh lehasiras roshi, that the son of this murderer has sent to remove my head. Ru'u, see, kevo hamalach, when the messenger comes, Sigru Hadeles, close the door, let's lock up the door. Ulechatzem oso badeles, you should pressure him at the door. Halo kol ragle Adona vacharav, the sound of the feet of his master will be after him. In other words, you shouldn't let him in the door, keep the door closed, and after him you'll see Yehoram himself will come to the door. Odeno medaber imam, he was still speaking to them. Vinei hamalach yoreid elav, and behold, the messenger was coming down to him. So the person who Yehoram had sent was now in sight. Vayomer, and he said, so Elisha said, Hinei zos hara'ah meis Hashem, this evil is from Hashem. I'm sorry. And the king said, this evil is from Hashem. Ma ochil la Hashem od, what can I hope more to Hashem? Meaning that the king realized that this is a curse from Hashem, and there's nothing I can do now to stop this evil. So Elisha knew that the messenger was coming before the messenger came, and he told the people to close the door to keep him out. And then he said, and the king will follow him. And that's in fact what happened. While he was speaking to them, the malach, the messenger came, and then the king came, and the king said, this evil is from Hashem, what am I supposed to do more? So the Navi is leaving out a lot of the conversation over here, because essentially what happens is the messenger comes, they don't let him in the door, the king follows, and then evidently Elisha and the king do have a conversation. And Elisha tells the king that, what do you want from me? Like, this is because of Averos. So the king says that I recognize this evil's from Hashem, but there's nothing I can do about it anymore. I can't, there's nothing that can stop this. This is a curse of Hashem, and it is already. Now, the king gave up hope of ever being able to change the situation, because it was a curse from Hashem. The Rashi here says that the king quoted the pasuk in the Tochacha in the Chumash that says ve'achalta privitnecha, that you will eat your children. You'll eat the fruit of your womb. That will be the punishment that the Jews have to go through. So since this is a fulfillment of the curse in the Chumash, he felt there was nothing that could be done more about it. Now, we'll pause in a moment. I'm going to read a little further. In the beginning of Perek Zion, Vayomer Elisha. So now Elisha speaks. Shimu Devar Hashem. Listen to the word of Hashem. Komar Hashem, so says Hashem. Ka'is Machar. At this time tomorrow, Sa'ah Soles B'Shekel. A measure of a saw of flour will be worth only a shekel. V'sasayim Sa'orim B'Shekel. And two saw of barley flour, because barley flour is worth less than wheat flour. So wheat flour will go for a saw for a shekel, and two saw of barley flour will be b'shekel, will also be for a shekel, b'shar shomron, in the gates of Shomron. So Elisha now predicts that they are going to be saved. Vayan ha-shalish asher la-melech nishan al-yado, and the shalish. Now shalish can mean a third party, as though from the word shalosh. It can also mean like an advisor. And here it means an advisor. So the advisor that the king was leaning on his hand, on his arm, the king being an older person, leaning on the arm of this advisor said, he answered, Es Isho Elokim, the man of Hashem, Vayomar, and he said, Hine Hashem osa rubos bashamayim, is Hashem going to make skylights in the heaven? Hayyeh hadavar hazeh, will this actually happen? So the shalish ridiculed Elisha's prediction that the famine will disappear. Vayomer, so Elisha answered, Himcha roe be'inecha, you will see this with your eyes, umisham lo sochel, and you will not eat from it. You will see it happen, but you will not benefit from the salvation of Hashem. And from here, starting with Pasuk Gimel, verse 3, we enter the story of the Arba Anashim, the four men, which we'll talk about in a moment, who are going, through them is going to come the Yeshua, the salvation that will save Shomron from starvation. This, starting with Pasuk Gimel, with verse 3, the Arba Anashim, is the Haftorah for Parshas Mitzora, I believe, in the Chumash. Okay. So, which makes sense, as we'll see, because it's going to deal with Tzara'as, as we'll see in a moment. Now, so what has happened over here? The king, Ben-Hadad, the king of Aram, decides once and for all he's going to take care of the Jews. So he sends a massive army, lays siege to Shomron, and there is a terrible famine. The famine is so bad, there's nothing to eat, that people have to resort to eating other people who have died. And then the king is faced with this gruesome court case, so to speak, where one woman accuses another woman of not keeping her end of the deal in sharing her child after the first woman shared her child. So the king is so sickened by this that he says, that's it. Elisha is going to be killed. So that's the king's reaction. Elisha knows of this threat before it actually happens, and he tells his people to lock the door and not let anybody in, which happens. Remember that Elisha had thousands of students. So it's not so simple to send someone to behead Elisha if Elisha knows that the person is coming. As if Elisha wouldn't have known the person was coming, in theory, the person may have come. And he may have said, Elisha, I have important business with you from the king. And Elisha may have stepped forward, and then perhaps the person could have attacked Elisha. It's hard to believe that he would have been able to actually hurt him, given the fact that it's Elisha. But still, in theory, at least there would have been a possibility. But once Elisha knows in advance that the person's on the way, simply telling his students to close the door and lock it up, there's very, very little way of getting to Elisha when he's surrounded by thousands, literally thousands of students. So Elisha tells them, lock the door and then don't let him in, and you'll see that Yehoram will also follow. Yehoram does follow, and then there's a conversation that is not clear exactly what the way the conversation went. It appears from the words that the Navi does record that Yehoram, that Elisha said to Yehoram, what are you after me for? It's not me you're after. You gotta, this is obviously because of the sins of the people. But Yehoram says, he throws up his hands and says, I can't do anything about this, because this is a curse that's in the Chumash, and the curse has come true, and there's no longer, Teshuvah is not going to do anything anymore. It's not possible. So then Elisha says that by tomorrow, this time tomorrow, the famine will absolutely disappear, completely disappear. And to which the Shalish, the advisor of the king, denies it. And so Elisha tells him that you will see it, but you will not benefit from it. That's what we read so far. Now, Elisha's prediction that tomorrow the famine will disappear is in fact a pretty bold prediction. Because even if suddenly the enemy would disappear, which clearly that's a prerequisite in order to get food into the city, but the enemy had already devastated the countryside. There was no food to be had even outside the city. Everything was gone, because the enemy had taken everything, which is what enemies normally do when they siege to a city. So it's not simply remove the enemy. You have to actually get food into the city, which is why the Shalish, the advisor, said, is Hashem going to make skylights in the heaven? Is he going to rain mun down? Because that's essentially the only way that food is going to appear out of nowhere, is that something's going to have to come down from heaven, because there's nothing left on the earth. So where exactly is food going to come from? So he ridicules Elisha. Elisha tells him that you will see this with your own eyes, but you will not eat any of it. The Gemara in Maseches Sanhedrin tells us that Hashem operates, as we know, midah keneged midah, measure for measure. Hashem operates measure for measure in every single way, in reward, in punishment. Everything works measure for measure, which makes a lot of sense. Because since Hatsur Tamim Pa'alo, Hashem is perfect, perfection would mean that everything has poetic justice. Everything, both for good and for bad. It all comes full circle. We don't always see it. In fact, we rarely see it. But at the end of the day, everything has to come out and line up perfectly. And the way that works is through Midah Keneged Midah, measure for measure. The Gemara says, the context of the Gemara is that a person who denies Tchias HaMesim, someone who denies the resurrection of the dead, will not merit Tchias HaMesim, and will get resurrection of the dead. The Gemara says, why not? Because he rejected it, so he doesn't get it. Midah keneged midah, measure for measure. So the Gemara then says, how do we know that Hashem operates measure for measure? Midah keneged midah. And the Gemara brings several proofs. One of the proofs the Gemara brings is this episode over here, that this advisor to the king ridiculed Elisha's prediction and said, how could it happen? So Elisha says to him, okay, you don't believe it's going to happen. You're going to see it, but you will not benefit from it. Midah keneged midah, measure for measure. You don't believe it, then you won't get it. And that's the same idea as a person who says, I don't believe that there'll be a resurrection of the dead at Tchias HaMesim, then they won't get it either. That's what the Gemara says in Maseches Sanhedrin. The questions that we have to deal with are, what is the point of what is happening over here? Meaning, there has to be a cause and effect, a one thing leads to another. Ben-Hadad comes and lays siege to the city. Hashem allows him to do that. In other words, the Jews do not have the military power to keep him from laying siege to the city and creating such a terrible famine. So apparently the Jews were doing averos. That is supported by the terrible incident of the women bargaining over consuming their own children, since, as Yehoram himself tells Elisha later, it is one of the curses of the Tochacha. And it says in the Chumash that if we do not, God forbid, we do not keep the Torah, then there'll be many punishments, one of which is eating one's own children. That is explicit in the Chumash itself. So if this is what happened, clearly it is as a result of sin, which is not shocking. We know that the northern kingdom was not the most righteous of kingdoms, and the people were not were doing avodah zarah. So this is a result of sin. Yehoram ben Achav is then faced with this gruesome court case, and that makes him react. So the question is, what was going on before this? His whole city is starving to death. It doesn't take this court case. This court case is just what brings it to light. But he doesn't need this court case. When he thinks that what she's asking for is food, he says to her, if Hashem isn't giving food, where do you expect me to get food from? So he knows there's no food in the city to be had. Everybody's starving to death, including him. There's nothing to eat. So what was his reaction before this incident with the women complaining over the broken deal? That's another point. A third point then is why is his reaction to behead Elisha? That's his reaction. I mean, we have to understand, what was he thinking until then? Why didn't he want to behead Elisha until that point? Well, what changed over here? So then we have that point. And then when Yehoram actually comes to Elisha, so what is the back and forth over there? That Yehoram says, nothing can help. There's a curse over here that Moshe Rabbeinu said. And then Elisha says, by tomorrow the famine will be gone. What did they do to deserve the famine to be gone? Whatever they did in the first place, did people stop doing the averos? Why all of a sudden now the famine's going to be gone? So how do we understand the progression over here of the story? Yes?
Is it possible that he had done shuva because he is wearing sackcloth?
He is wearing sackcloth.
So if he was such a rasha, there had to be some merit there.
Yeah. So you do see that somehow he is acknowledging some sort of tshuva, especially since he does say to the women, this evil is from Hashem. He does say to the women that if Hashem isn't going to help you, where am I supposed to help you? So he acknowledges over there that this is from Hashem. He doesn't believe that it's happenstance. And then later, when he actually is face to face with Elisha, he says, this evil comes from Hashem. What more can I hope to Hashem for? So there is some, even though Yehoram ben Achav was not a tzaddik, but there is some acknowledgement of Hashem going on over here. Correct.
There's the back and forth, because he also, you always look to blame somebody. So this is Elisha's fault, but he didn't stay with that, which was a good thing.
Right. That's right. He does come away from that blame.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So just to clarify, both women's children were dead?
Yeah.
Okay.
Both were dead.
All right. That.
Yeah, even in the Chumash, when it says this curse, it's referring to dead children. It's the Gemara says that this curse has happened several times throughout Jewish history, where people have resorted to eating their own children. But the Medrash itself, when it says this, says no one killed their kids, God forbid. It's after they've died with nothing to eat. And that's how bad the famine was.
And when we were learning about David and how he respected Shaul because Shaul was king, even though Shaul was trying to kill him, here you don't seem to talk the same way about Elisha or his students, that they would listen to the king and revere the king. Is that because it's the northern king and he's not?
Yeah, well, Shaul. Because Shaul was a big tzaddik. We emphasized that many times, that no matter what Shaul did, at the end of the day, Shmuel says that Shaul is with him in Olam Haba. Yehoram is a Rasha. Yehoram is the one who took money with interest from Ovadia the Navi. Like he's not a good person.
Respect for the king doesn't have to be just because of the king of Israel. It has to be for how much Talmud Chacham they are.
So no, there's respect and there's respect. We find that Eliyahu ran in front of Achav, even though Achav is a huge Rasha. He still ran before Achav because the office of the king deserves a certain respect. So that much, yes. Here he locked out the messenger of the king. He didn't lock out Yehoram. He had a conversation with him when Yehoram came. He locked out the messenger because the messenger was there to execute him, so he locked him out. But then he also, as he says, Yehoram is coming behind him. He wanted to force this conversation, which is going to play into the give and take over.
Okay, so then my third question, which is kind of leading to this, is he was kind of right. Elisha could have ended it.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. That's
so
a good point.
It's
also
kind of like,
and he does, and in fact, he does.
He does end it.
Right. I mean,
right.
He does announce it's going to be over.
Right, the next day.
Right.
But
right.
Why does he wait till the next
okay,
day?
Okay. Good. Good. Yeah.
What happens to this oath that's made?
By the king?
When people make oaths, you know, it's supposed to come about in some way.
No. Only if,
not necessarily?
No. Tzaddik makes an oath that comes about.
Oh, not a Russia.
Yeah.
His oath doesn't count?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's he gets an avera for saying an oath. He shouldn't have taken one.
So there was no consequence to it?
Well, there may have been to him personally.
What?
There may have been to him personally. For having taken an oath, a person takes an oath they're gonna run around the block and they don't do it. They get an avera for taking that oath.
Oh, okay.
So as we said, there was as we keep seeing with the Northern Kingdom, there are terrible averos going on, and as a result, Hashem brings Ben-Hadad, who's going to lay siege to the city and cause terrible, terrible tsaros to the city, and people died. You see, the kids died, but other people died too. It wasn't just a famine. It was famine meaning people died of starvation. It was a terrible, terrible situation. The Gemara, in comparing famines, says that this was a particularly terrible one, and that's why the Navi tells us in Pasuk, Chafein 25, that the head of a donkey went for 80 kesef, etc. It's to show you how bad the famine was. This was a terrible famine.
What about in Echad? There's, you know, several places in the Tanakh was famine.
Yeah, yeah. But let's stay. Okay. Let's with it. Okay. So this was a terrible famine. So the king is over al Hachoma. He's walking on the wall. So what is the king doing? What's he doing? So we don't know what he's doing, but we do know that he's wearing sackcloth under his clothing. So he's in a public place where he can be seen. He is wearing sackcloth, but it is not visible to the people, which means that the king has not yet made a public statement that it's time to do teshuva, although he himself has realized that they better do teshuva. So he's got on sackcloth. But it's not something that everybody knows about. So he hasn't yet taken a stand, which would have been a pretty bold stand for a Russia king to take. In Nineveh, yes. By contrast, when the king finds out about this Yonah's proclamation, the king wears sackcloth, he gets off his throne, he sits on the floor, he puts ashes on his head, and he announces, everybody is to wear sackcloth, everybody is to do tshuva, everybody has to stop all their thievery, etc., etc. Yehoram is not ready to make that public announcement. But we do see that he himself personally has begun to change. He at least I mean, it's not a permanent change, but has begun at least some modicum of improvement.
Well, it's recognizing what's happened, and I think these two women just...
Okay. So when the women, he's on the wall where people can see him. Now, what would a king be doing although people can see him? Most likely, he's trying to give people a sense of confidence, of leadership. He's there. He's presenting himself. He's not sitting in his room somewhere. He's on the wall where everybody can see him. He's not sitting there having hoarded food and feasting. He's there like everybody else, but he's in a place where he can be a leader. On the wall, the women call out to him. So it's for a woman to call out and say, help me. So she's one of thousands who could have called out for help. So he says, look, what do you want me to do? We're all in the same boat. Like, I'm up here on the wall to show you I'm also starving. We're all starving. This is not there's no privilege over here. We're all in the same boat. So what exactly are you asking for? But then he realizes she's asking for something more. So he says, okay, what is up? So she tells him, I'm not coming to you for food. I'm coming to you for justice because of what this woman did to me. So he's like, that's what we've come to? Like, this is, it's so bad that we're bargaining over eating children? Like, this is crazy. So he tears his clothing. Why did he tear his clothing? So usually tearing of clothing is a sign of mourning. But here, it may have also been a sign of mourning, but it seems the tearing of clothing was to reveal to the people that he's wearing sackcloth. He did it expressly to show everybody, we are in trouble. This is no longer something which, you know, well, it's happenstance. Well, it'll correct itself. I don't know. He says, we are in trouble. This is horrible. And he tears his clothing and shows, look, I'm wearing sackcloth. It caused a stir. People pointed. People said, whoa, look at that. Which, therefore, caused a reaction of the people. Now, how would the people react? Well, you're going to get a mix of reactions. Some are going to react with, well, if Yehoram is doing teshuva, we must also do teshuva. That would be the best reaction. Yeah. You'll also have those who will say, ah, Yehoram, he's a turncoat. He's going back to the sages, those fanatics, right? Who is right? You'll have that also. You have all kinds of reactions, but it will cause some people to do teshuva. That is what's going to happen over here. But it's a very brave thing to do because it's going to it's tipping his hand. It's showing where he's at.
Rabbi,
now, yeah.
Where are we? I mean, could he have sent a message to his brethren and? He's
under siege. He can't get anything yet. There's no way to get
anything. He didn't see him coming. He didn't see this happening.
I don't know. I can't tell you. Now.
And they don't hear about it.
Let's continue. Hold on. So now his reaction is, I'm going to kill Elisha. That's his reaction. We got to kill Elisha. That's what we got to do over here. So what is the gain in killing Elisha? As if he's really starting to do teshuva, why kill Elisha? So here you have the following logic. Hashem brought this punishment to us. I acknowledge it's because of sin. I'm doing teshuva. I'm even willing to show people that, look what I'm doing. And people reacted to that. The famine doesn't end. It's still here. And look how bad it is. And women are bargaining over dead children. So he says that teshuva is not going to work. It's not enough over here. Moshe Rabbeinu says in the Torah that this is the punishment for sin. This is what's going to happen. So he says, we're over the top. There's nothing, teshuva is, of course, has to be done, but it's not going to end the famine. The only way the famine can end is teshuva, yes, but also Elisha davening for us. Without Elisha davening for us, the teshuva isn't going to work. He reasons that when you have someone as great as Elisha in your midst, then you need that along with the teshuva. And since Elisha is not davening, and we are now doing teshuva, or at least we're doing as much teshuva as can happen in this country, because I'm doing teshuva, and whoever sees me as is and is inspired to teshuva is also doing teshuva. Not everybody, but whoever is possible to do teshuva is doing teshuva. So this is the best we're going to do. And Elisha is not davening for us. Well, then Elisha is the cause. He's a sinner himself, because he's a sinner for not having removed the famine. And therefore, he deserves to die. It's actually the will of Hashem that Elisha dies, because he's a sinner, because he's cruel and evil, that he's not removing the famine. So he sends a messenger to execute Elisha. But the messenger isn't able to get in. Now, the messenger would have been able to get in had Hashem not tipped off Elisha that messenger was coming. Well, if Hashem tipped off Elisha, the messenger is coming, clearly Hashem doesn't want Elisha dead. So the whole logic is obviously contradicted by the fact that Hashem tipped off Elisha and told him that the messenger is coming. So by closing the door and not letting him in, that projects to Yehoram, that's why did Yehoram follow the messenger? Because that projects to Yehoram that he's wrong, that his whole logic, that it's Elisha's fault, is flawed. So Yehoram comes when he finds out that the messenger got locked out. Because he says, how do you get locked out? What do you mean? Remember, when Gehazi was there, you weren't allowed in. Or he didn't let everybody in to see Elisha. But once Gehazi's out of the picture, everybody can come see Elisha. It was an open place. So you could come, And anybody could come in and sit down and be part of that shir. So here, how did it get locked out? The only way it can get locked out is because Elisha knew about the whole thing. Well, then obviously Horam's wrong. So Horam throws up his hands and says, okay, if I'm wrong and it's not Elisha's fault, then why isn't he davening? What's going on? So he comes to have a conversation with Elisha. This forces the conversation. And Yehoram comes, and he comes with humility, and he says, what am I supposed to do? This is a curse from Hashem. What am I supposed to do? What can I hope to Hashem more? To which point Elisha says that tomorrow the famine will be gone. Now, the question is, why tomorrow? Why didn't Elisha just say, the famine is gone? We know that's happened before, that Elisha is able to snap his fingers and things just happen. So what is this that it's, he says, tomorrow will be gone? So the clue to this is the reaction of the advisor. What does the advisor say? The advisor says, ha, what are you talking about? Now, that shows us there was one more thing needed for the famine to end. One was teshuva. Elisha had to daven, it's true, but there was one more thing needed. And that was?
Belief.
That was belief. That was bitachon, emunah. That was saying that I trust that if Elisha, and Isha Elokim says that the Navi is, that the famine is going to end, that it is going to end because Hashem can make skylights in the heaven. Yes, He can. Because Hashem is unlimited. And whatever Hashem wants can happen in the blink of an eye. And even if you and I and a million brilliant people cannot fathom how it's possible for it to happen, that's because we're puny human beings. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu can make anything happen at any time, and He's totally unlimited. There is nothing that can't happen. And as far-fetched as it seems, yes, it can happen. So when the advisor reacts in this way, he plays right into that last piece. Elisha says to him, okay, you are not going to enjoy it. Now that's in effect saying to everybody, you hear that? If any of you want to benefit tomorrow, your job between now and tomorrow is to believe that Hashem can do it. You're not believing in me, Elisha. I'm just telling you what Hashem is going to do. You have to believe that Hashem is capable. The Shalish didn't say, Elisha, how do we trust you? Who are you to know what Hashem is going to do? We don't believe you, Elisha. He didn't say, Elisha, you're not a Navi. He said, could Hashem do such a thing? He doubted Hashem's ability. Mm-hmm. That's what he doubted. So Elisha says, oh, you doubt Hashem's ability? You're out. You're locked out of it. You're going to see it, and you're not going to get anything out of it. Which is the same thing as telling everybody else that the last piece in this puzzle is believe that Hashem is unlimited. When you believe Hashem is unlimited, add that to your teshuva, add that to my davening, that's it. The famine will be over. And that sets the stage for the Arba Anashim, these four men who are now going to trigger, or they're not going to trigger it, but they're going to be part of, as we'll see, they'll be part of the Yeshua, the salvation that is going to happen. There we have the progression over here that happens in this episode between Elisha and Yehoram, these women, and then this Shalish, this third party. Yeah.
So the king was right that Elisha wasn't davening. He just drew the wrong conclusion. But he was right about that. Wasn't davening.
Elisha may have already davened, but it wasn't. There was another piece that was necessary, which is the bitachon. That was still necessary. The people had to believe that Hashem can do anything. That was the last piece.
So
we don't know whether Elisha davened now or davened earlier. That the king reasoned Elisha must not have davened because the famine would have ended.
But that's not necessarily the case, you're
right,
saying.
Right.
So what was the point of the famine in having all these Jews die? I mean, is it, would Hashem kill a lot of Jews in order to make this point and get them to do Teshuvah?
Well, remember that they did Averos. They right. deserve to die. It's not. We're not talking about children. That's a whole different discussion. But the people deserve to suffer. They had done terrible sins. So they deserve to suffer. We can't understand when it is that Hashem decides to punish and when He decides not to punish. We always daven that Hashem should be marech af, that He should give us a long time to do teshuva, and He shouldn't judge us, etc. We daven for that all the time. But the reality is there are times when Hashem does punish, and this is one of them. So the question was how to end the punishment. As we have in the Chumash as well, like in Parashas Korach, where there was a plague which was punishing the people, and then Moshe sent Aaron to bring the Ketores and stop the plague. The plague did prevent the Ketores did prevent the plague from killing more people, but 14,700 people were killed. That was a punishment. So here, a certain amount of people, it doesn't give us numbers over here, a certain amount of people were killed, a terrible death, but in the end, the rest, whoever did survive, would have died as well, but they were spared because of this turnaround.
So going into this story, we know that the king is already wearing sackcloth. There's some degree of teshuva, at least on his part.
Right.
We don't really know what Elisha's been doing. He could have been davening for, you know, at some point.
We have to presume he was, just because he's Elisha.
So let's presume he was. So the whole thing boils down to this shalish.
Well, also the rest of the king... Having the courage of showing everybody, which then brings more people into the teshuva process,
right.
And you have that as well. It's not just that you can imagine it was a difficult thing for the king to play his cards.
Well, I wonder about that. You know, I mean, these were his own people, and he's keeping it to himself that he's doing teshuva. And yet in Nineveh, you know, which is a goyish place.
That's why Yonah didn't want to go to Nineveh, because he knew it would reflect badly on the Jewish people.
Yonah is
actually going to come up a little later on. Not in this story, but the next story Yonah does come
so
up.
So the whole story about Yonah is predicated on his previous experience here with
Elisha. Yonah comes up. He is alive. He's not the story of Yonah with the fish on it. That hasn't happened yet.
But he was a witness.
Yes. And he, right. That's correct. Yeah.
Okay. When we flip back and forth to the other kingdom, does it at all reference that they knew that this is not, I find it hard to believe.
They may have known, but they couldn't get here. Ben Hadad was powerful. They couldn't break the siege.
But they could have davened for the brethren or do something.
Maybe they did.
Something from afar. We don't know.
Yeah, maybe they did. The southern kingdom at this time was weaker than the northern kingdom. Remember, Achav in his day was the most powerful king in the world. That has since deteriorated, but still, the northern kingdom is more powerful than the southern kingdom. We're gonna toggle back and forth soon. We've been on this one for a long time because of Elisha. We're going through all the miracles of Elisha,
but it needed all the parts. You're saying.
I'm sorry.
You're saying it needed all the parts.
Yeah.
Right now, the other thing when we're going through these miracles of Elisha, I haven't seen you refer to how they're double.
Yeah, we're gonna get when we forget to finish all the miracles first.
Okay, we'll go, and then we'll explain Some of them don't seem double to me.
Yeah, he's only brought one person back to life so far.
Okay, right. so another one's coming.
Well, you know, it's not exactly what it appears to be. Yes, we'll see. See, there'll be more.
Okay.
Is this supposed to be parallel to Eliyahu who's ending the drought?
Well, it certainly could be. It certainly could be. We'll make a list once we have a chance to see. Okay. Now. The Navi now shifts its focus. We've been inside the city this whole time. Now the stage moves to outside the city because there are four Jews outside the city. What are they doing outside the city? They have tzaras. So people who have tzaras cannot be inside the city. So there are four Jews from Shomron who are outside the city. Now, if they're outside the city, that means that they must be hidden outside the city because the army of Aram is all around, and if you catch four Jews, they're not treating them nicely. So these four men, when the siege started, must have hidden themselves away. It is possible that the fact that they have tzaras is a deterrent, because tzaras is highly contagious, and therefore it is possible that the people of Aram don't want to get near these people. Remember that we have Naaman isn't that long ago, and he had all that. So he had the tzaras before, so who knows? But it doesn't appear that the people of Aram knew of these four people. So these four people outside the city. Our sages tell us these four people are Gehazi and his three sons. Gehazi, who Elisha cursed him that he would get the tzaras of Naaman, that Naaman had tzaras, and now it flipped on to Gehazi, and Gehazi has it, and he and his children have it as well as three sons. These are the four people outside the city of Shomron.
They're going to have it forever.
They're going to have it forever, yes. Now, we're going to see as we go through the story that these four people are going to be pivotal in saving the city of Shomron, which is significant because if Gehazi was in fact so terrible, and the Mishnah tells us he loses his portion of the world to come, so he must be pretty bad, then we have to understand how is he playing a role in saving the city. So that is an outstanding question, which we're going to deal with not this week, but next week. So we'll begin reading the story now, but we're going to have to pick up on this question, Mitzvah Hashem, next week. So Pasuk Gimel, verse 3. V'arba anashim hayu mitzorayim pesach hashar. There were four men who had tzaras at the gate of the city. V'yomru ish al re'ehu, one man said to his friend, Ma anachnu yoshvim po, why are we sitting here on masnu until we die? Im amarnu navo ha'ir, if we say we should come to this city, in other words, maybe we should go into this city. V'hara'av bo'ir, but there's famine in the city. V'masnu sham, we would die there. So even if somehow we got into the city, we broke the rules of Taras, and we went into the city, well, we'll die there because there's nothing to eat. V'yim yashav nufo, but if we stay here, v'masnu, we're also going to die. There's nothing to eat here either. V'atai now, l'chu, Finipla al machane Aram, let us go and let us fall to the hands of Aram. Im yechayunu nichye, if they let us live, we will live. Vim yemisunu vamasnu, if they kill us, then they will kill us. Meaning that if we go into this city, we'll die of starvation. If we stay here, we'll die of starvation. Those things are certain. There's certain death in the city. There's certain death where we are now. If we give ourselves up to the camp of Aram, then what's the worst that will happen? They'll kill us, which is the same thing as staying here or going to the city. What's the best that will happen? They'll let us live, and they'll give us food to eat. So here we have a suffix, we have a doubt, and we have a vada, we have a certainty. Certainly going to die here, certainly going to die in the city. Suffix, we have a doubt whether we'll die in the camp of Aram. Therefore, it makes sense for us to, at this point, give ourselves up to the camp of Aram. The Gemara asks the question, what about Chaye Sha'a? What does Chaye Sha'a mean? Chaye Sha'a means life. Sha'a means for the moment. Which means as follows, that we know that life is precious. Every moment of life is precious. The Halacha states clearly, over and over again, then one is not allowed to hasten the death of a fellow Jew under any circumstances. One is not allowed to cause someone else to die more quickly. Even if the person is going to die, but we're not allowed to hasten that person's death. That is why the rules of goses apply. A goses means a person who is within moments of death, that they are on their last breath. So the halacha is that we're not allowed to move a goses at all. We have to leave the goses alone because the concern is that if we were to move any limb of the goses' body, we may cause the goses, God forbid, to die a few minutes or even seconds before they were to die otherwise. And that is prohibited. Life cannot be ended any earlier than it was supposed to end. We're not allowed to do that. This is where you have the issues of artificial when there are machines that are providing respiration and circulation, of turning off machines, this is where you get into that issue of causing death prematurely. This is also where you get into the question of a person who is in a vegetative state, God forbid, whether it is permitted to withhold nutrition and hydration, whether that is permitted or not, boils down to this question. Because even though the person may end up dying anyway, we're not allowed to hasten the death. And the halacha makes it clear that withholding food and water is considered hastening a death. That's why we're not allowed to do that. We have to provide food and water even when a person is in a state where they are going to die anyway. So there's chaye sha'a. There is life for the moment. So the Gemara says, with this logic that they're going to die anyway if they stay here or if they go into the city, so they may as well give themselves up to Aram, but that doesn't take into account chaye sha'a. Because if they stay here or go into the city, yes, they're going to die of starvation, but it may take a day or 2 days or 3 days. If they go to Aram and Aram doesn't like them, they'll kill them immediately, which means they're going to shorten their lives by whatever it is, a few hours, a few days, whatever it is. So how do they have the right to go to Aram where they may gain life, but they may lose chaye sha'a, they may lose life for the moment. So the Gemara says, proves from here and from other places as well, that in this circumstance, the opportunity for the potential of permanent life, now life is never permanent, but it means averting the immediate death that the person could experience, the chance of living, that overrides the risk of losing chaye sha'a, of losing temporary life, of losing life for the moment, which means like this. A person is not allowed to risk their lives just for anything. A person is not allowed to say, I'd like to get a thrill, so I'm going to do something which is life-threatening because it'll be a thrill for me. A person is not allowed to take their life into their own hands, not allowed to do that. Person is not allowed to risk their lives for, you have to define what it means to risk one's life, but one is not allowed to risk their lives for money or for, a person says, I'll give you $1 million if you'll be willing to jump off the third floor, and if you live, I'll give you $1 million. Not allowed to do that. You can't jump. Not allowed to take money to do that. But if a person's life is in danger anyway, and they are going to die, but there is an opportunity that may save their lives, mm-hmm. but the risk is that if it doesn't work, they may die more quickly. In that situation, we do not take into account the fact that they may die more quickly, and it is permitted to take that risk in order to live. This is where the question of experimental medical procedures come in. A person who is, God forbid, and in a terminally ill state, and the death is imminent, and there is a possibility, an experimental possibility that may, or maybe not experimental, there's a procedure which has, let's for argument's sake, say a 50% chance of success, but if it fails, the person will die more quickly than they would have died otherwise. So we see from here that it is permitted in that case to risk dying more quickly in the hope that the 50% chance that they will live will be achieved. Now there's two factors here that I'm not prepared to deal with in this forum, but just to raise the issue is, number one, how great does the percentage have to be? What if it's only a 2% chance that the person will live? That's how great of a chance there's a need to be in order to override the risk of dying more quickly. That's an issue. And another issue is, let's say it's 50%, and let's, for argument's sake, say 50% is enough of a percentage. Is a person required to try that 50% chance of living? That's, were they required to go to the camp of Aram? Let's say the camp of Aram was a 50-50 chance. They may kill us, they may let us live. Okay? But if we stay here, we're for sure going to die. But if they kill us there, then we're going to get killed more quickly than staying here. So the Gemara says, you see that it is permitted to take that risk. Is one required to take that risk? That's not clear from this discussion. We're just showing that it is permitted, but we're not showing that one is required to. So that comes into play as well. But these are all modern day medical halachic questions are based on this story and others like it that the Gemara discusses.
For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.